Hello and welcome to That's in Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey.
And I'm Vinny Damopolito. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, first, Rosemary Armeo discusses ongoing wars in Ukraine and Gaza with Wall Street banker Mark Whitman and international educator Jim Ketterer. Then, Willie Terry speaks with Reverend Ibrahim Pedrinan to discuss the positive and negative aspects of the labor movement in 2023 and shares his thoughts on what to look out for in 2024. After that, Bria Barthel chats with Chloe Whitaker, Adult Programming Director at Troy Public Library, about the many varied events coming up in the Troy Public Library. Finally, we turn to Marsha Lazarus, conversing with well-known criminal justice advocate Dr. Alice Padden Green about why Dr. Green resigned 3 years after being appointed Deputy Commissioner of the New York State Division of Probation and Correctional Alternatives, and how that experience, along with her career as a teacher and social worker, led her to start the Center for Law and Justice. But first, here are the headlines.
Three Rensselaer County officials facing federal criminal charges for voter fraud have filed pre-trial motions challenging the government's case as their September trial date looms. The defendants include Richard Crist and Jim Gordon, top aides to County Executive Steve McLaughlin.
The Gazette reports that Schenectady County has issued a request for proposal for a comprehensive study of the condition of the Museum of Innovation and Science, MISCI. The county, museum, and assemblyman Angelo Santa Barbara reached a deal last month to keep the science museum in its current home for at least 5 more years, with the county agreeing to fund an engineering study of the building in order to identify potential infrastructure improvements.
The city of Troy will start a door-to-door canvassing of residency starting at 2 p.m. Saturday, April 20th, to inform residents about lead pipe testing.
6 men have been arrested and charged in the Montgomery County town of Florida in a sex crimes against children investigation, with at least 15 charges against them. The Times Union reports that, quote, troopers and the sheriff's office partnered with the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force program to set up stings where the men believed they were meeting with underage people for sex, end quote.
The Capital District Transportation Authority, better known as CDTA, Wellness Way, and Capital District Physicians Health Partners, or CDPHP, and Community Care Physicians, CCP, are teaming up with to help locals get to the new medical center in Colony. The CDTA have added the location as a stop on the 182 route bus, Troy, Albany, Cohoes, and Latham.
UAlbany football star Amitrol A.J. Simmons Jr., a standout player during the 2023 season and potential NFL draft pick, has died at age 25.
And our last headline comes from Public News Service.
Today is National Healthcare Decisions Day, and New Yorkers have reason to start early planning. A new report finds rates of Alzheimer's disease growing among the state's 65 and older population. With a projected 460,000 older New Yorkers being diagnosed with Alzheimer's by 2025, Corinne Carey with Compassion and Choices feels the best first step for healthcare planning is exploring a person's values. She says many questions should be considered during the planning process.
Is it important for you to be free from pain at all costs? Is it important for you to be treated the way that you want? Is it important to you to know how your body will change? Is it important that you not be connected to machines?
One way to help people get started is Compassion and Choices Dementia Values and Priorities tool. It's designed to help people document their healthcare wishes before developing dementia or an illness affecting their decision-making abilities. Experts advise people to revisit and update their plans every 5 to 10 years rather than chuck them aside in the filing cabinet. Some people delay healthcare planning because they feel it's hard to have these conversations. Jessica Empeño, also with Compassion and Choices, says not having a person's wishes creates numerous challenges.
There is a much higher risk for receiving treatments that may not be beneficial, that could be burdensome and could be really expensive. You know, co-pays and things like that are not inexpensive for people.
She adds, if a person moves or travels a lot, they should have more than one advance directive. One challenge in planning can be the options a person has, such as considering certain surgeries and understanding the side effects of different treatments. Empeño notes that having a professional sit down and review these options can help people feel less overwhelmed in healthcare planning. Edwin J. Vieira reporting. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
And that's it for the headlines.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, listener-supported radio that builds community in Troy and the surrounding capital region through broad grassroots participation.
Our content is produced by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or give us a call at 518-272-2390.
The conflicts in Gaza and the longer battle in Ukraine have not died out and, in fact, are threatening to spread wider. Rosemary Armeo teamed up with Wall Street banker Mark Whitman and international educator Jim Ketterer, her colleagues from the WAMC Roundtable, to talk about the suffering, the threat of worse to come, and dim possibility of peaceful settlements.
I'm Rosemary Armeo, and you are listening to a segment of the most recent Armeo on the Burn podcast. War in Ukraine has been grinding on for more than 2 years, and the conflict in Gaza for more than 6 months. Is it time for the U.S. to force its allies towards peace, even if that means lots of costs and sacrifice? So your answer to my question is that despite the protests, despite the obvious anger and upset with his incompetence or worse, he's safe for now because it's such a bad situation.
Yeah, and I think you have to keep in mind, even if he were to himself call the question and say, okay, I'm done, that's a 3-month delay between when a next government takes place. And even the moderates fear what the far right within his coalition would do during that time. They haven't called for elections more broadly because of Chuck Schumer. They've done it because they literally can't find an opening as to when they would or wouldn't do it. Netanyahu's got himself in the best position he could possibly be at this point.
Yeah. Jim, talk about Netanyahu. And you're right, Mark. Chuck Schumer, who has never said a bad word about Israel, has even praised Trump when it comes to Israel. He's such a loyalist. Even he felt brave enough to condemn Netanyahu. His own people have come out in record numbers to protest against him. He's extremely arrogant and despicable man. He is no Zelensky. And yet, is it true that he's in for quite some time yet, still in Israel, in your view?
Well, yeah, there's all kinds of people. And even before October 7th, there were all kinds of people who were sick of Netanyahu and wanted to see him go. And I mean, people in Israel. So we've seen more and more of this. After the initial shock of October 7th was over, then, you know, people really started to say, number one, Netanyahu and his government are responsible for a colossal security failure. That right. It's not just that Hamas carried this out, but that they were able to carry it out. And that with a small patch of land that is absolutely surrounded by the most advanced technological gear, and one of the most sophisticated intelligence and security forces that on the face of the planet, that Hamas was able to do this with bulldozers and hang gliders. Israelis are just absolutely beside themselves that, you know, Netanyahu's deal with them basically was, well, I might be a very unpleasant person and unpalatable to you politically, but I can keep you safe.
Right.
And so he's remained unpleasant and unpalatable. But he hasn't.
And now he's kept him safe. That's very well done.
And so that's one thing. And really, Netanyahu himself, in this particular arrangement of the government and this cabinet, is really held hostage by the very far right. And I have seen, you know, every time Netanyahu starts to give in a little or show some level of understanding of what the Americans are saying to him, that you almost immediately get Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and others like that who jump in and say, you know, we need to press on, we need to do X, Y, and Z in the kind of most maximalist approach to this, which was, I think, always a mistake. It doesn't make Israelis safer. It's not rooting out Hamas. It's in fact increasing support for Hamas. I think it's an absolute fantasy to think that some kind of operation in southern Gaza and Rafah is going to kind of like permanently eliminate Hamas. You've actually created more Hamas sympathizers in the West Bank in the last 3 months than ever existed. So without any political horizon being articulated by the Netanyahu government, with them being held hostage by the right wing, but in the absence of any other clear alternative, maybe Benny Gantz, but nothing has really built up a head of steam there. It seems that he's the very worst of a lot of bad alternatives at the moment.
Oh, and it sounds like Trump you're describing. Oh, my goodness.
Well, you can connect that dot as you like.
Exactly. You brought up the West Bank, which is my next question. I have been worried as I watch what appears to be some sort of a pullback from Gaza, and I have never thought it was Israel giving up. I think it's redirecting or redeploying forces towards Lebanon. Do you see that as a possibility? I sure do. I'm worried about that.
Toward Lebanon?
Yeah, yeah, where there are also terrorist forces against them, Hezbollah.
I mean, you know, Hezbollah and the Israelis have been playing a tit-for-tat game for a long time.
It's been escalating yeah, while the world's been distracted by Gaza.
It has been, but, you know, Israel has been down that road before, literally down that awful road of invading boots on the ground in Lebanon, and it created a national cataclysm for Israelis. I mean, it was, you know, horrible. I mean, I think one of the things that was a result of that quagmire that they entered into was the creation of an emboldened and very dangerous Hezbollah. They ended up creating the very thing that they were there to fight against. And we can see this being replicated now in Gaza, but also in the West Bank. So, you know, I think that there might be some increased activity, but I don't really think that Israel is going to take this extra step and escalate it fully into Lebanon. And I, you know, I am certain that the Americans behind closed doors are saying, you know, absolutely do not do this. That would be.
Yeah, they're also saying watch for Iran. And we saw what happened with the bombing of the Iranian embassy.
Yeah. You mentioned the West Bank, though. I mean, what's happening there? When what was happening even before October 7th, over, you know, in the life of this current Israeli government, you know, settlers basically were green-lighted to engage in very aggressive, violent displacement of people, violating what was already kind of a Swiss cheese arrangement of areas A, B, and C across the West Bank, making it even a more unlivable situation for Palestinians, a very explosive situation. And since October 7th, it's gone even more, I mean, exponentially, you know, just off the charts. And it's really getting very little attention. There was just a decision to appropriate, I think, 2,000 acres of land. And there's been more and more and more of this going on. So, again, I think this is the right-wing part of the Netanyahu government that is trying to create facts on the ground that will be almost impossible to undo after the fact.
Mark, let me give you a chance to get in here. I want you to take on an even bigger question, and that is there a possibility that of all of this terrorism and suffering and famine and just the whole horrible mess, that we could end up with the two-state solution, where there would be something for Palestinians and something for Israelis?
I think Anthony Blinken suffers from delusions when he says that within the foreseeable future, he's going to have a credible path to a two-state solution. If he does that, they should name the Peace Prize, and frankly, they can name every other prize given from every high school and college in this country after Anthony Blinken. If you think about it, at the beginning of this war, Netanyahu said he was going to destroy Hamas. That was a promise he was never going to keep. And simultaneously, the United States had thoughts of grandeur that it was never going to fulfill. I think it is inevitable, given the Israeli disposition, and I think we as Americans, if you think back to 9/11 and imagine a case where the Taliban had taken hostages, for God's sake, I think it's inevitable that they'll have to sort it out militarily in Rafah. I think we as the United States should use our suasion to make sure that the Gazans are treated humanely, and this is more of a Mosul than some other type of situation. I think it's also inevitable that we're going to have to bring Iran. You have to bring Hezbollah to the table and therefore Iran to the table before you get everybody in neutral corners, because there are I think it's 100 and some thousand Israelis that are displaced because of the threat of missile attacks from Lebanon currently. So I think the United States has to help Israel manage through this. And by the way, this is what the Israeli government told us they were going to do. They told us there was going to be a massive incursion. Then they were going to pull back on the periphery of Gaza, but they wanted free rein to conduct, you know, selective or surgical military strikes. So this is going according to their plan, by and large, although they haven't gotten the hostages back, but no one should be surprised by that. I think until Rafah is basically been searched and Iran has had a, you know, come to your religious deity of choice moment and calm things down so that the Israelis can move back, I don't think the Americans can do anything but manage the situation as best they can. Once that's all happened, then we can talk about, so, you know, longer term solutions and all the rest of it. But I think Anthony Blinken doomed his own efforts with aspirations of grandeur at the beginning of this. And by when I say Blinken, I mean the administration generally.
The administration, he spoke for them. Jim, you concur, or do you have a different view?
Well, you know, for quite a few years, no one in any place other than Washington, D.C. had any thought about the two-state solution. You know, it was among certainly Netanyahu and the people supporting him. He has never been supportive of that, and he's been very vocal
years
not being supportive of it, and has worked against any possibility that it would happen. And, you know, Palestinians have largely given up on it being anything remotely like two actual states,
right?
And that it would be, at the very best, it would be some kind of Bantustan or something like that, which is completely unacceptable. So, right. Understandably so. So, it's been dead on arrival. We have seen it come back into conversation in a way, and I would say one glimmer, a kind of hope about it coming back into conversation is not that it's necessarily going to end up as a likely direct result of this conflict, this immediate conflict. But I think there are more and more people realizing, well, we have to think of some sort of political horizon on this. I mean, it can't just be tactical issues of Rafah and what's happening there and how many troops are moving there and what are the settlers doing in the West Bank. In the absence of it, not just for the sake of the Palestinians, though of course I think that's hugely important, but also if you're an Israeli, you should be saying, we cannot live in a situation where this is a constant kind of military operation after military operation that is done by us or to us, back and forth. This is no way for Israel to exist. So on the Israeli side of things, on the Palestinian side of things, everyone is, I think everyone of any sense and any goodwill is saying, well, we have to come up with something. And then the question is, well, what is the something? And again, the devil is in the details. I want to just say, though, that there are some people, shockingly, not shockingly, who are not of goodwill. And I will tell you that one of the things that was floated to me by some people at the very beginning of this conflict, and I really dismissed it at first as just kind of a crazy fever dream. But with the way that Netanyahu continues to say, we're going to carry out these operations in Rafah, this is going to happen no matter what, I'm starting to believe it. And that is the following scenario, that there are those people in Israel, and there's people on the other side of the border in Rafah in Egypt, and there are some in Washington who are thinking, well, really what should happen is that a humanitarian crisis of even greater proportions than what we already have will be created in southern Gaza. And under the heading of this crisis, and as a humanitarian gesture, many Palestinians will be moved into the Sinai on the Egyptian side of things.
Right, right.
And when that happens, you can be pretty darn sure they're not coming back. I mean, there was an interview maybe 2 weeks ago, or perhaps a bit more, where Jared Kushner was saying that, you know, there's some great real estate in Gaza. And what we really need to do is kind of, you know, clear it out and just start again. Well, what does clear it out mean? When we hear Smotrich or Ben-Gavir talking about clear it out, they're less subtle. And they're not jokey about a real estate deal. They're just talking about ethnic cleansing. And then you've got Egyptians on the other side of that border who are basically being paid off to the tune of like $50 billion from the international community to be receptive to fever ideas like this. And there are people in Washington, not just Jared Kushner, who are floating them. So it's one of those things I thought was so crazy and so horrible that it couldn't possibly be true. And this nightmare continues to metastasize. And I don't know if it's going to end up being true, but there are enough people floating it and enough people in power trying to make it happen that I'm concerned.
Oh my God, you guys, I have missed this so much. This has been an amazing conversation. I feel like we just began and I'm horrified looking at the clock. We're going to need to cut away and take a break. We'll come back for last thoughts from each other and for our toast.
Rosemary Armeo brings us abbreviated versions of her podcast, Armeo on the Brink, weekly. Hear more at our website, mediasanctuary.org, or find the full versions on YouTube, Armeo on the Brink.
And in this week's labor segment, roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry speaks with Reverend Ibrahim Petrinan to discuss the positive and negative aspects of the labor movement in 2023 and shares his thoughts on what to look forward to in 2024. This is part one of a three-part interview.
This is Willie Terry, a roaming labor correspondent for the Hudson Mohawk magazine. And today I'm at the labor temple in the office of the Reverend Ibrahim Petrinan, who's president of the Albany County Central Federation of Labor and the American Postal Worker Union Local 390. And how you doing?
Well, it's a rainy day, but we're smiling in this sunshine, right? of labor power.
I hear you. Now, I know you're a very busy person because you're the president of two major organizations in the capital region. Before I get started with, you know, any of the other specific questions I have, why don't you tell us something about those organizations and your role in those?
Sure, sure. I'll go chronological. So I started off becoming the president of the Albany County Central Federation of Labor. The Albany County Central Federation of Labor, or the Albany Labor Council, a delegate body from 40 union locals representing 30,000 union members in Albany County. So any union can send delegates based on how many members that they have to the Labor Council, and that body can work on resolutions, can work on organizing campaigns, not in the sense of organizing them into the Labor Council, but organizing campaigns as in supporting other unions or other locals, or just training people on what organizing looks like and how to build power for workers. That's the Labor Council that meets the first Wednesday of every month, unless we change it, which we've had to do a few times because I was traveling and then I was sick, and they decided that I was important to be there, which was sweet of them. I feel superfluous sometimes. I'm also the president, as you mentioned, Willie, of the American Postal Workers Union Local 390. That covers both Albany and the Plattsburgh area. So we've got about 60 out of the 65 offices in the 129 zip code. So it's pretty much from Westport all the way up to Rouse's Point, and then all the way over to like Brushton and Cranberry Lake. So it's a pretty wide area. It covers most of the Adirondacks.
How many workers?
So up there, it's a smaller number just because the offices are very spread out. So we've probably got about 80 workers up there. And then down here in Albany, we cover the processing and distribution center. And that is... has challenges in and of itself that are coming down the pike because of the Postmaster General and because of new postal policies and lots of things. But we cover about 500 folks down in Albany City. So we cover the stations and branches, any place that you go in to get a stamp. We also, though, have a vehicle maintenance facility. We have obviously drivers that come in and out of the facility, and then we've got maintenance folks as well, and mail processing clerks. So a whole bunch of folk that we cover here in Albany.
So what's your role in that process? You have to do what?
So my job is a bulk mail technician. So I deal with quantities of mail, massive quantities of mail. So whether that's the Solidarity Committee newsletter coming in, whether that's the Department of Motor Vehicles or the Department of Tax and Finance, or any number of large mailers that send out bulk quantities of mail. Really anything that you get that doesn't have a stamp on it, I've probably touched.
Mean the union.
Absolutely. But I don't do that role anymore, so I'm a full-time officer.
Right.
So as a full-time officer, right. Now we're getting a can of worms, more like a bucket of worms, just because it's so much. So I'm in charge of all the legal, financial, kind of vision of the union, plotting out the calendar, working through the different projects that we have in terms of grievances and trainings, and we're hosting the National President's Conference here in the fall. And so there are always more things on my to-do list at the end of the day than there are at the beginning, even though I knock out a good chunk of it. You know, there's always more to do and never enough time to do it.
Right. Yeah, when you do meetings and...
Oh, yeah, meetings, interviews, talking with politicians, and right. Especially with a lot of the changes that are coming, we're needing to utilize our public allies a lot more, letters to neighborhood associations and folks who want to keep a vital and vibrant post office in their neighborhood.
Right. Now... I know one of the things I want to ask you is, like, I remember last year, 2023, the labor was in the news a lot.
Absolutely.
Because of things they were doing.
Right.
So I want to ask you, what are some of the positive aspects of last year's issues or movement in the labor that labor was doing, and what were some of the downturn?
Sure. Well, some of the downturns, anytime workers get power, that's when big business and billionaires and corporations and companies and managers and bosses, that's when they start pushing back. I think that we're going to start to see prices keep rising. You look and you see that the profits for companies are ever increasing, and so are the prices. Well, there's a direct correlation between prices going up and profits going up. And incidentally, the workers' wages are staying the same. Now some of the unionized campaigns, I think, have really had an impact on wages. You've seen that companies are now kind of starting to voluntarily increase their wages because they have to. Because when a union wins, the union raises the floor, and then everybody has to kind of get there. And that's one of the reasons why managers and bosses in big business push back, because they don't want workers to win those things, because that means they have to pay out more money in wages and benefits. And so whenever we have those victories, it affects the workers, obviously, but then it affects the entire community, because now companies have to pay people more. So on our labor council meeting last night, we were introduced to the MIT living wage calculator. And for this area, a living wage is $22.33, and that's just MIT's calculation. Now, in terms of, when as prices go up, the living wage has to go up. The minimum wage in New York is what, $16. So there's that. I also think, to your question, the inspiration that unions and union victories have given to the public are really important.
Well, you were instrumental in the Starbucks.
Well, we tried to make sure that workers knew that we supported their unionization efforts. We're actually going to we're going to be having a meeting on May 1st at 10 a.m. at the New Scotland Starbucks, because they are one of the unionized Starbucks, and we want to just celebrate their unionization. They were one of the last ones in the capital region to announce. And so we're gonna be there on May Day, International Workers' Day, at 10 a.m. I think so. Sean Fain, who's the president of the auto workers, he put forward that we should really be trying to put our contract end dates as May 1st, 2028. And so I know Troy Area Labor Council, they passed that resolution. We passed that resolution last night. And now, so that's something that we have to work for. It's an aspirational goal, but I think it gives us power when workers can stand together. And as you know, the ruling class in this country has really tried to separate workers from workers in other countries. And that's why we have our Workers' Day in September, but the rest of the world has their Workers' Day May 1st. And so, you know, Sean Fain, I believe, is truly trying to reunite the USA labor movement with the global labor movement. There was a really smart guy who said, you know, workers don't have a country because corporations don't have a country. All these multinational global companies, they can go wherever they want, which means they can exploit workers wherever they want. And so workers similarly don't have a country. All we have is our solidarity across class lines.
You talk about a lot of positive things. What was some of the drawbacks?
Yeah. Well, like I said, I mean, I think bosses started pushing back. I think unfortunately, you know, the news cycle is now just a whole lot of stuff on war and politics. So they're trying to change the narrative. They're trying to make us forget those labor victories over the last year. I don't believe there are any drawbacks when labor has victories, but I know that it affects the ruling class. I know it affects the bosses and the billionaires, and they want to silence that, and they want to silence that with wars, and they want to silence that with political machinations and the BS coming out of Washington. They want to start, you know, talking about the presidential election. Right. And understandable, the presidential election matters. But also, you know, if all we care about is, you know, casting our vote one day in November, and we forget what happens, you know, one day in October, 30 days in October, 30 days in September, you know, I think we do ourselves a disservice. Mm-hmm. Our power is not one day a year. Our power is every day.
We appreciate Reverend Ibrahim Pedrinan taking the time to talk with us about the Evergreen Labor Movement. This was part one of a three-part interview
with Roaming Labor Correspondent Willie Terry. For those of you just tuning in, I'm Sina Bazilicki.
And I'm Vinny Damopolito. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany, and streaming online at mediasanctuary.org. This program comes from the media Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
If you like what you hear, you can support this program by sharing our content. You can also, if you listen through your podcast app, rate us, like us, share us. Find today's stories and more at mediasanctuary.org.
And now we turn to Bria Barthel, who sat down with Chloe Whitaker, Adult Programming Director at the Troy Public Library, to talk about the many varied events coming up at the library.
Listeners, if you're looking for things to do in April and May, I have some suggestions coming to you from Chloe Whitaker, Adult Programming Director at the Troy Public Library. Chloe, welcome back to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you, Bria. It's always a pleasure to be here with you.
And it looks like you have a very full schedule. So listeners, go to their website, because there's a lot more going on than what she's going to talk about. But she is going to talk about some cool things. What's first?
Yes. So to start today, I actually want to talk about what we just did on Saturday. We had our first ever fabric swap here at the library. We had over 50 attendees and many more people who donated fabric. So it was a great way to bring in new fabric, get rid of your old fabric, all at zero waste. We are planning to do it again in the fall, which is why I bring it up now. So mark your calendars for September, October, and hopefully we will be doing another one of these. So keep your fabric stored.
In other words, quilters and fabric collectors, start going through your stash now because you've got a noble way to get rid of it. Pass it on.
Exactly right. So one of the other things we're doing, the beginning of every month, we do our adult take and make kits. And this month we have garden starter kits. So these are herbs or dirt, organic seeds for a bunch of your spring herbs, parsley, chives, thyme, oregano, mint, that kind of thing. We are going to be replenishing our stores. So by the time you're hearing this on the radio, we will have more. So please stop by the main library to pick up take and make kits for this month.
So everything you need to start a garden is in the kit, the container, the soil, and the seeds.
Yes, and the containers are biodegradable. So it, for ease of transplanting, you can actually just take the whole container, put it in a new bigger pot as your herbs start to grow.
So if you're inspired by Earth Day and want to do something for the earth, they give you some of the earth. Okay, and next.
So for one of our crafts this month, this is one of our afternoon crafts. So if you don't like driving after night or you don't want to do something during the day, on the 22nd of April, we have a felt frog keychain class. So I will be teaching some basic sewing skills and we'll be making little cute frogs out of felt that you can use as charms, you know, or keychains, however you'd like. So that is that. That's 2 to 4 p.m. on April 22nd.
So it's not felt frog like you're getting warts on your hands from touching frogs.
No, these are wart-free frogs. and you can customize them to make it the perfect frog that is the perfect cuteness level for you.
But they won't become princes.
You never know. I'm not saying everyone has a little bit of magic, so I won't say that that won't happen. And then later that week on the 27th, so April, every month has so many different things being celebrated. So it's Earth Month, it is Poetry Month, and it is also Jazz Month. So we are doing a jazz performance on the 27th, a Saturday at 1:30 p.m. with local jazz group MC Squared. And they are wonderful. This is actually through a grant, so please come by and see them.
So MC Squared, they're probably high energy.
Yes, and these are a lot of classically trained musicians too. So you're getting a really great performance. And this is a family-friendly event. So you can bring your kids to this. With our last performance, there were a lot of strollers in the room and it was a lot of fun.
Sounds wonderful. And next.
So on the 29th, we have our first open mic night in recent memory. We're calling it Tea and Poetry, so people can sign up and just come and sit and listen to poetry being read aloud, or they can come and on the night sign up to read some poetry. So it can either be something that you means a lot to you, a poem that already exists that you love, or if you do want to read one of your own works, we encourage that. Each poem is going to be 3 to 5 minutes long, and there'll be refreshments provided.
And that's part of National Poetry Month. When I came in, the front circulation desk has a poem in extra large sort of refrigerator magnets of different words. So listeners, stop by and read it.
Yes, and a little story about that display as well. The person who did it, Emma Rinaldi, she is a local artist as well, and she does a lot of our displays. She asked the head of circulation whether she should do a display of fridge magnets in a poem or a lot of little ducks with umbrellas. And the head of circulation said, please both. So if you look at the desk, you will notice there is a poem and underneath there is a row of ducks with little umbrellas as well.
And when you come in to the left on the front of the circulation desk is the poetry and the ducks. But to the right, there are two different large bulletin boards that list some of the many other activities going on, the flyers for different activities. And then straight ahead, so that you're surrounded by information. There's a calendar that lists everything by calendar date.
Yes, and I take a lot of pride in these calendars. It's what I'm referencing while I do this interview right now. I try to make them extremely cute. So please take one, put it on your fridge. It's supposed to be something that you don't mind looking at, but it also has all the information you need.
And I see that May is maybe National Strawberries Month. There's a lot of strawberries there.
I have themed May's calendar strawberries because for me, it is the beginning of strawberry season, and it felt like an appropriate motif to use.
So maybe you can give us a little bit of information about your role as adult programming director in terms of, do you come up with all these cool ideas for activities, or do people come to you, or some combination? How do you figure out what to focus on? Because you've got so freaking much.
It is a lot. I guess it is, it's a mix of both, as is are a lot of things. So I do reach out to people specifically to do certain events that I think would be cool or fit a theme. Sometimes other people in the department come to me with ideas that they would like to do, and we make it work. And other times I just, you know, when you do this for long enough, you tend to have a lot of contacts in the community. And so as people have ideas for things that they want to put on at the library, they will just send me emails, and I get to say, oh, sounds great, please come on such and such a date. So it's a good job.
And then we're in a second floor room that has lots of skeins of yarn and books on crafting and crochet hooks. What's with that?
We were doing a weekly Wednesday knit and crochet evening that is going to be starting back up again in the fall. We've paused for the summer to give our instructor a little bit of a break because she does this on a volunteer basis. But probably pretty soon there'll be even more yarn in this room as we bring out even more stores for our next round of crochet nights. And then there'll also be some classes coming up where people can learn to do it if they've never done it before.
Any other sneak previews of things that are going on, reading clubs or anything else, or things that are in the works that you might want to tap on people to volunteer to help with?
Yes. Well, there is one more thing that I want to talk about that's happening in May. And this is actually an example of an organization reaching out to me to do an event, and I was so happy to do it. So May is Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month, and we are very privileged because Monday, May 13th, from 6 to 7:30 p.m., we're going to have a panel of professors, so doctorate-level speakers, coming in to talk about Asian American studies and the reach of that in storytelling, in heritage, and in the work that all of them do at their various universities. So more information on that can be found at our website. But I would encourage a lot of people to come to that.
And for all of these various events, do you need to register in advance? Can you just show up, a mix? How does it work?
It is always best to register to ensure that you have a seat, and that can be done on our website, thetroylibrary.org, or by calling us at 518-274-7071. And yeah, that's just, I would say that is a good rule of thumb, is register to make sure you can make it to the event, because we often have a capacity limit for some of our rooms.
But the take and make kits with the full garden supplies, those you can just pick up anytime the library is open?
Yes, if we have them, you can come in and just grab them.
And then a reminder of where the main branch of the Troy Public Library is.
You can find us across from the Russell Sage campus and next to the courthouse, 100 2nd Street, downtown Troy.
Now, listeners, I'll just warn you that if you come in the next little while, it's going to be a very large plywood encased front because they're doing outdoor renovation work. But if they say the hours are open, they are open. You just have to find your way through the plywood. Thank you very much. That was Chloe Whitaker, Adult Programming Director at Troy Public Library's Main Branch, talking with me, Bria Barthel, for Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Thanks, Chloe.
Thank you, Bria.
Bria, our library correspondent, visits the Troy Library every month and brings us a few stories from there. We just heard a little bit about Learn to Sew, the jazz concert, open mic tea and poetry, take and make gardening kit, also that lecture for AAPI Heritage Month coming up in May. And if you didn't catch all that, because who would. It's all in the description, on the story, on our website. You can hear all of it again. Catch those details. Mediasanctuary.org. Find it there.
And finally, we turn to Marsha Lazarus in conversation with well-known criminal justice advocate Dr. Alice Padden Green. We will learn why Dr. Green resigned 3 years after being appointed Deputy Commissioner of the New York State Division of Probation and Correctional Alternatives, and how that experience, along with her career as a teacher and then social worker, led to her starting the Center for Law and Justice.
I've always been concerned about how we deal with crime and the fact that we tend to believe that people have to be punished without understanding all the forces that come into play that create the environment and conditions in which they live. And that there are other ways of dealing with those kinds of problems, behavioral problems or whatever you want to call them, that punishment doesn't work and that prisons don't work.
Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine. This is Marsha Lazarus sitting with passionate and staunch criminal justice advocate, Dr. Alice Padden Green. Alice, I thought we'd start with the organization that you started in 1985, Center for Law and Justice, still very much alive 40 years later, and sadly still very needed. How would you describe the center's mission?
Okay, the center is basically concerned about two things. One is educating people in the community about the legal system and the political system, because they're very important parts of our society that affects people that I work with particularly, but it affects all of us. The other thing is advocacy. We advocate for social justice, and that could mean anything and everything, depending upon what's going on in the community, issues that come up out of nowhere sometimes. But social justice advocacy is our main focus.
I was reading in your book a little bit of your career journey, and you started as a teacher right after college. And you went from, it sounds like you went from the classroom to working as a social worker and then actually got your MSW, got a social work degree in order to do that. It sounds like for you, it was your caring and compassion for the young people or older people or adults that you worked with. You were motivated to assist them, to be of support. It was that caring that you had for them. I think about your work, you know, over the last 40 years, fighting for justice are two very different kind of ways, styles. What do you think motivates you more? The caring for the individuals or the desire to fight for justice?
I think they come together. certainly, I think I'm compassionate because of the environment in which I was raised. I understood the problems that my mother had to overcome to be a good mother. You have to find ways to feed your kids, you have to clothe them and all of that. At various times, we had to depend upon welfare. I didn't see that as something negative. You know, it's that was how we survived. And so when I met people, particularly like in Albany, there was one family. I saw a mother who looked like my mother. And she was a grandmother, but she was caring for many, many, many people because she had, you know, 6 or 7 grandchildren. She would take people in and who were either homeless or suffering. And at one point, right down on Pearl Street in this apartment, there were 19 people living in this actually one-bedroom apartment. It was unbelievable. But she was committed to helping because they were her children and they were people in the community that she knew. And so I got a lot from her, you know, about being compassionate. Not only from my family, but her family as well, because I understood what she was going through, because I knew what we had to go through when I grew up. So when I first started out teaching, I wanted to know more about the students, because it was in a low-income Black community. I wanted to know, you know, what were they faced with and how are they dealing with it? What's their families like, and what kind of help did they need? So I made a point of visiting all of my students' homes. And after a while, of course, it sort of caught on in terms of one of the things you could do is be a social worker, and you could spend all your time doing that. So I did go back to school to get an MSW. And so, and when I'm doing the work as a social worker, unfortunately, it brings you into contact with the criminal justice system, because most of your clients are going to have some kind of, tie-in with the system in different kinds of ways. So I wanted to know more about that system, because I felt the system had to change. I didn't think people were responsible for a lot of the things that happened to them. They're not necessarily responsible for poverty. There's institutional racism that makes sure that you stay put where you are. And there was a medical system that didn't know how to deal with you, educational system, all of that. So you can work with the individual, but you also have to look at the system and what it does and how it delivers, what kinds of policies does it create that affect the people who are in poverty. So I don't think you can separate the two, that I think people have to be compassionate. When I hire somebody at the Center for Law and Justice, that's a lot of the thing we talk about, that that compassion that's needed to do the work. And but we still committed to social change and changing everything that we can deal with that we think impact the lives of the people we work with. And so that includes law enforcement and a lot of the policies that our legislators come up with. It's a struggle.
At one point in your career, you were appointed by Governor Mario Cuomo to the position of Deputy Commissioner of New York State Division of Probation and Correctional Alternatives. And 3 years after this appointment, you resigned in protest over the governor's increased building of prisons.
When I was given the position of Deputy Commissioner, I thought it would be an opportunity to maybe affect change in terms of how we actually deal with people. Rather than in prison, let's divert them. And so I did that for a while. But then when we started building all these prisons as a result of Rockefeller drug laws, and prisons were being filled up, I could look at the statistics every week, and so it going up and up and up and up. And I was really disappointed in that. I said, wow, I can't be a part of that. Looking at upstate New York, where most of those prisons were built, from, you know, in my hometown area, as a matter of fact, they built one of those prisons right across the street from my home in Witherby. And so I started looking at it closer and doing some research, and one day discovered that there were a whole lot more people in the census that were Black and from the Adirondacks. And I said, wow, this is, I never see anybody. So what's going on here? And discovered that because of the census and people were counted where they were incarcerated, we found out that 70% of the people who lived in the Adirondacks who were Black were in those prisons. And so it's sort of like a slap in the face kind of thing. And I said, wow, this is crazy, because I know where these people are coming from. They're coming from New York City. They're coming from Albany. They're coming from, you know, Rochester and Buffalo, from Black communities and brown communities after a while. So so I spent a lot of time working on those issues around mass incarceration. The positive thing was I learned a lot from people who were incarcerated. They taught me so much about how the system works. Prison, they call prison industrial complex, and how we have to maintain a certain level of incarceration And that's what mass incarceration is all about. That's what the Rockefeller drug law was all about. So I learned a lot from them.
Do you see that spirit of truth-seeking activism, wanting to make change or make a difference? Do you see that spirit in either your children or your grandchildren?
Especially, I have a granddaughter that I see that very clearly. She's at Boston U right now. She learned very quickly, you know, like I remember taking her Halloween trick-or-treating. We were going to go to this one house, and she said, no, we can't accept candy from them. Because she identified that this person was part of a political party that she had been told had problems. So she says, no, we're not going there, you know. But she's incredible, very much into doing stuff with incarcerated people. Now she's decided she wants to be a lawyer and help people. She's definitely committed, yeah.
She's following after grandma's footsteps.
So I'm happy about that.
Marcia Lazarus talking with Dr. Alice Payden Green.
Marcia Lazarus had a longer interview with Dr. Alice Payden Green, and this is the third part of that three-part series. So you can find parts 1 and 2 at our website, mediasanctuary.org. And that is our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Sina Bazile-Hickey.
And I'm Vinny Damopolito. We thank all our volunteers who made today's episode possible. This is a team effort. Rosemary Armeo, Zachary Grady, Willie Terry, Bria Barthel, Marcia Lazarus, and Mark Dunley have all contributed to today's episode.
All of them.
All of them. This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community for the community and is supported by independent donations. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org.
And we want to hear from you. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook at Hudson Mohawk Mag, or send us an email to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Tune in weekdays at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news, or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. Full episodes and individual stories are available on demand at our website and on your favorite podcast platform.
Thanks to you, our listeners, for making this all worthwhile. Have a wonderful evening.